Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Morning. Yeah, fine, thanks. Yeah,
I'm delighted to hear it. How's Carlos doing?
it's all right. I had this last of the first set of chemo and immunotherapy yesterday. He seems all right. We'll see if it's working.
Yeah, it's powerful stuff, isn't it? All strength there. I wonder if we could start. Well, where do we start? We have Trump careening around the world. We have Hurricane Melissa. We have Lucy Powell. I imagine relatively calmer waters, a skilled political operator, a slight tilt to the left for the current style agenda, do we think?
It's a clearly the membership wanted to poke the Prime Minister in the eye with this, so chose the candidate whom he'd sacked from the shadow cabinet recently rather than the one that was his obvious favourite. But there's always an argument, yeah, with a chief and a deputy. You don't want your deputy to be a carbon copy, otherwise there's kind of no point in having them. Part of the role of the deputy is to whisper in the Prime Minister's ear, "You are mortal." So I think a bit of we think of Tom Watson and Jeremy Corbyn were pretty much on opposite wings of
I was going to say, there's an odd
the
couple
Corbyn
if there was one, yeah.
one. Yeah, indeed, and yeah, we've seen it, and there's been other times when it's been more harmonious. One thinks of John Major and Michael Heseltine going back a while, but Geoffrey Howe was Deputy Prime Minister. And he was given that job because Margaret Thatcher couldn't stand him, and it was a to slightly sugar the pill that he was being sacked as Foreign Secretary. So I don't know, I mean, it's an interesting one in the Labour Party because it is a directly elected position, which gives it a legitimacy. In most places, the deputy is appointed by the leader and kind of serves at the leader's pleasure. That's not the case with the Labour Constitution. I mean, I still remember on Newsnight when someone raised the issue of the grooming gangs, and their immediate response was, "This is a dog whistle," which I thought was utterly and absolutely disgraceful. And I think
That's
that's
inadequate.
it's something that's going to follow her round, I suspect. But we'll see how the relationship develops. The Labour Party, there have been some polls which have put Labour on 16%, neck and neck with the Greens, which is, well, we're in completely uncharted territory. I don't know what happens. It all goes back to the fact that the point of the Labour Party is to spend the fruits of a strong economy, which they've been bequeathed by the Conservatives, on people who deserve it, so improving public services. And if they've haven't got that money to spend in the first place, it looks very possible. It's very interesting that a few months ago the Prime Minister was asked, "Will you absolutely stand by your manifesto pledge not to raise the big three taxes, national insurance, income tax, and VAT?" And he said yes. Cameron Badenoch asked the same question in pretty much exactly the same wording this week, and the response that came back was much, much less unequivocal. So it does look like, Labour are seriously mulling the idea of breaking what was one of their central manifesto promises on tax. But on the other hand, what do they do? Because if you want to raise a lot of tax, those are the only three you can go to. You can tinker around with little taxes at the edges. But if you're determined that you're not going to seriously attack public expenditure, which Labour does seem to be determined not to do, then you've got to put up one or more of those big taxes.
I would.
And I don't forget, one of the first measures that Geoffrey Howe took when he became Chancellor was to increase VAT. It's been done in the past.
But in the context of a cost of living crisis, I think it might sit a little uneasily with the general public.
Well, there's no easy answer to this at all. Absolutely, if you put VAT up, then you get a boost in inflation, immediate boost to inflation, and that then reflects on the levels of benefits you offer because they're generally inflation linked, or at least partially inflation linked. No easy answers. I suspect she may need to bite the bullet and put up income tax, but that would, on the other hand, I'm sure she's aware that would just completely and absolutely shred the last hint that you could trust the Labour Party to stick to its manifesto.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? I mean, the Blairite sort of shtick that I think Starber has sought to emulate, perhaps, it existed in a Germany that itself was economically stable for the longest time. There was a sort of pact between the corporate sector and the unions, and everybody sat round over a beer and sorted things out, as Harold Wilson once envisaged. Times have changed, really, haven't they? We're dealing in a multinational world where the economy, the whole tilt of the economy, can almost turn on a sixpence. And a certain flexibility perhaps has to be sold to the general public that didn't really find itself to be necessary before.
Yeah, so I think if you go back to Gordon Brown's day, and the incoming Labour government in 97, said that it would stick to conservative spending plans for the first 2 years, which are very interesting. I don't think the Conservatives would have stuck to those plans, but Labour could say this is, there's a lot of interesting stuff in game theory about this, about how very often it's in your interests to limit your options. It would seem, on the surface, you'd think, well, having as many options as possible is a good thing. But if there are certain things that you really don't want to do, then finding external ways of removing those options, you quite often find conservative councils, the leader would quite often say, we can't do this, the unions wouldn't wear it. Well, they're quite happy to attack the unions when they or challenge the unions when they want to. But if it's something they don't want to do, then blaming the unions for not being able to do it can be quite useful PR when it comes to managing the troops who are disappointed in you. And I think there's an element of that in what Gordon Brown was doing. To be fair, that Labour government was pretty prudent with the economy, certainly till the later years. But part of that was that Brown could say, no, we went to the electorate saying this. It's what he wanted to do anyway, but he could say, we can't veer away from this because we went to the electorate promising it. Now, the economic situation is just so dire at the moment, despite Kevin Bacon not saying that we bequeathed a good economy to Labour. No, you didn't. It was a dreadful state. And Labour saying we're really getting to grips with improving the economy. No, you're not. It's continuing to drift. Bond rates are now higher than they were at the height of the Liz Truss fiasco.
Good
The international,
heavens.
the, yeah, it's happened for a little while now. It come down just recently, but that's on the back of international bond rates coming down. But they're still up at or above that level that we reached. The international community has less confidence in the British economy than it had at the peak of the Liz Truss fiasco. So these are horrendously difficult situations, and coming on top of that, of the evidence that's coming forward, it seems very clear that the Chancellor herself broke the law when it came to renting out her house and didn't get it licensed properly. I'm not sure I'd want to be Chancellor of the Exchequer at the moment.
Is it time for a big speech from Reeves or indeed Powell to set out a stall? And what sort of conversation should be being had in order to, I suppose, create some sort of level playing field in terms of internal relations? How do you manage the situation
Well,
like this?
I think anything from Powell would be seen as an attack on Starmer at the moment, and I'm sure she will recognise this and will pipe down as it was. A couple of things that she said about direction were could have been read as being critical of the current leadership. I don't know what Reeves does. If she does raise taxes, then her credibility, her personal credibility, I think will be shot in much the same way as the party's credibility will be shot on this. And I don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe the business around her renting out a house might end up as a pretext for her resigning from a job that clearly, when she broke into tears in the Commons, it's clearly taking a big personal toll. And of course, why wouldn't it? It's a big job, which at the moment is practically impossible to do. So I wonder whether she may decide at the end that it's not worth the stress that it's causing for her, which is always sad in politics. I think But whatever one thinks of the abilities of someone, we should always remember that they are human beings who, by and large, have gone into politics for the right reasons. And I think we had our council meeting last week, and there was a motion from Labour on celebrating diversity and inclusion, and it was pretty much used as an attack to sow divisions with the prospects of reform. I was amazed that Labour focused so much on reform, because I don't think reform are really a force in inner London. But it was, under the guise of inclusion, there was this most dreadful series of divisive speeches from both sides, really, but I think particularly from Labour, since it was their motion. And so it's always a way to, well, it goes back to 1984, and it's very a big theme of yes minister and yes prime minister, that Sir Humphrey would in chatting with Sir Arnold about what Sir Arnold was going to. Sir Arnold had been cabinet secretary. Sir Humphrey took over as yes minister, became yes prime minister. There's a wonderful conversation between the two, where they are explaining to each other, but of course explaining to us, how if you've got a difficult thing, you get the difficult bit away in the title. So if you want secret government, you produce a white paper called Open Government, and then the whole paper is about how you stop people finding out what's going on.
At all costs,
And
that's
there's a lot of truth in that, that you can, if you get the title right, you can come up with the most dreadful set of nonsense underneath it.
and I suppose that there's an implication there that that's the sort of thing that reform might be producing in terms of its position papers. It might be a good time for it to make economic hay, I suppose, with the Reeves, as you say, somewhat existentially in the doldrums.
Yeah, I mean, this is the question over reform, is where do they really stand economically? Because so far they've not come up with anything coherent at all. On the one hand, they seem to be committed to massive public expenditure increases. They want to renationalise all sorts of things, which, even if you've got Thames Water, you could probably pick Thames Water up for very little in the marketplace, but you would be saddled with its enormous debts, which would have to come out of public expenditure, and that would compete with money for hospitals and for schools and for whatever else, defence, all the things that are important at the moment. And they're talking about, bringing anybody under 20,000, I think it was, out of tax, which will be a massive hit to the exchequer, without any real sense. There's a few savings around net zero that they could probably deliver, but it doesn't really add up as an economic philosophy at the moment. There is still a door open for the Tories to make a comeback as the only party that's economically on the right and recognises the importance of sound finances, but they've got to get over their own record of having been so poor at doing that in the course of the last administration. The up to I mean up to leaving Brexit, actually, I think the economy was quite well run, but then a combination of factors, the costs of Brexit, the Ukrainian invasion, and COVID all coming at the same time. Any government would have struggled financially with that, but the Tories certainly exacerbated things by wasting all this money on PPE and a whole range of things that just seemed, certainly in the public mind, seemed to be there just to enrich their friends. It'll be a long time, I think, before the Tories escape from under that impression.
Well, if you look across the pond, that's the explicit agenda of the Trump administration economically, really, isn't it? It's the, the trickle down to end all trickle downs that isn't trickling very much.
Yeah, I mean, the American economy seems in a reasonable state. It's in terms of disposable income, in terms of growth, it's really uncoupled itself from the European countries where it used to be a comparator. Now it seems to be well ahead in many of those areas. Now, whether that general wealth is reaching the less well off is very much another question. But compared to where much of Europe is, I think states are not somewhere where we should be particularly critical, I think, overall at the moment.
To what do you attribute this success with, which I think will surprise a lot of people who look at these things from the perspective of, well, I suppose Democrat voters, but people who are disenchanted with Trump, as is reflected in his current quite significantly negative ratings.
Well, there's been moves on regulation. The if you look at AI, which is the big emerging sector of the economy, where you've got China and the States and Europe as the three possible hubs, and there's some quite amusing Venn diagrams that have been put out around here. But the States, the Chinese, forging ahead in terms of the practical applications. The States forging ahead in terms of the research and the innovation. And Europe forging ahead in terms of the amount of regulation it's piling on the sector, and it's a yeah we are in that position in Europe that
You've got to have these
regulation.
things, but they're just coming from different corners of a sort of semi-globalized world.
Well, we could we you know we and we need to be in a position of our industry being allowed to do what they do, which is grow. But we've seen in and the big thing really, I think, in many areas of Europe is energy prices, which are dramatically higher in Europe than they are in the States, or most of the States. There are exceptions. California is extremely expensive these days, but we've got the costs of the new grids necessary for renewables, the costs of managing intermittency. Germany's seen its manufacturing industry really beginning to flee Germany now at an extraordinary rate. You mentioned earlier about the great, the economic miracle of Germany post-war, which, as you rightly said, was based on, around the left and the right, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats politically, who were the two dominant parties right until the turn of the millennium, and beyond, really. But they could work together, in the sense, that the SDP was very comfortable with firms making big profits as long as they could tax those profits to spend them on public services. And the unions and industry, and the unions and management, had a very close relationship, that they all saw the benefits of a German industrial revolution, and so would work together, clearly, keeping an eye on each other as they should. But there was a sense that the goal of a revived Germany as an industrial power, superpower really within Europe, was something which overrode a number of other issues, particularly in the regulatory sphere. I'm not saying their regulation was lax; it wasn't, but it was recognised that you couldn't overregulate things. I think the greed influence was very pernicious around that. Development. It was. You began to see the decline there, and then the energy vendor, the energy approach, which saw them closing their extremely efficient nuclear stations and going over to much more expensive and unreliable renewables, which has been very devastating for energy prices there, and increasingly in the UK as well, where we've got the highest energy prices in Europe at the moment. So I think there was a there still is in the States an idea that the economy is the most important thing. I think we lost sight of that rather in Europe, and still have lost sight of it. And we can't properly look after people who have difficulty fending for themselves if we don't have an economy that's making a lot of money that we can tax to provide those the help that we'd like to give. And we've kind of lost sight of that, I think.
And there you have the Reeves conundrum. Graham, good morning. Sorry you've had trouble joining us this morning. Oh, still no audio. I wonder if we, having talked about the economy, Graham, we could shift across to Trump's globetrotting and apparent, or so he claims, in his with his usual grandiosity, cessation of eight conflicts in as many months, basically on the predication of variations of trade deals. And the Phineas Barnum effect of this is one thing, but do you think it is sustainable in terms of the particularly those who are left out of the of some of these negotiations? Can you hear me, Mal?
Oh, sorry, I thought you were trying to talk to Graham stuff. I mean, Trump is Trump. I've always, or increasingly, I've thought that it's a mistake to underestimate Trump and to be too dismissive of it, because reflecting on the fact to be elected twice as U.S. president with a gap in the middle, which has only ever happened once before, is it's an interesting position. Now, part of that is because the Democrats in the states are seem to be deliberately trying to alienate one group of people after the next, I think there've been just a few things like the murder of Charlie Kirk, which have been, I think, in the states have caused quite a lot of people to reappraise where they stand in a way that's brought them closer to the Trump position. I mean, he remains a egotist and someone who's, we've kind of, there's been a few people in politics where you get to a point that you're so used to them lying and dissembling that that kind of gets discounted now. Boris Johnson was one. I think Alan Clark, who was a member of parliament in Plymouth and then in Kensington and Chelsea, son of Lord Clark of Civilization. But he
There's another
was,
odd couple,
when he was, he had a dreadful record for personal infidelity and the like. And when he was applying for the Kensington and Chelsea seat towards the end of his political career, and someone said to him, "And are there any skeletons in the closet we should know about?" And he said, "My dear, it absolutely rattles with them." And that never did him any harm in his political career, because it had reached a stage that it was kind of, no, he could get away with things that practically nobody else could. And I think Trump is in that position of being able to play, people in the States anyway, kind of expect him to go around with all this bluster that's pretty much clear nonsense. And the idea of him getting the Nobel Peace Prize for what he's done so far was always farcical. But you expect it of him and you discount it. No doubt at all, Trump has grasped the idea that trade is it's an extremely powerful political weapon, which he's been using in all sorts of ways. Now, it's a massive exaggeration to claim that he has single-handedly stopped all of these wars. But we do reflect on the fact that the Trump 45 was the first president in living memory who had not started a war, who had not opened up a new war for the states to get involved in. His actual record, I think, is pretty impressive in that area, whatever we might think of him as an individual or the way he goes about things.
There's often people said this of Thatcher and the Falklands, didn't they? Whether or not that's correct, but that there's often an expediency when you're sort of politically in the doldrums to embark on some sort of adventure, and the cost-benefit analysis suggests that there will be sort of an economic ripple effect. If you take it's a bit of an abstruse example, I guess, but this war in Sudan. Turns out, apparently, according to Al Jazeera, to be have lying beneath it vast mineral reserves, which are being fought over by the one side, the dominant side at the moment, that's being funded by the United Arab Emirates with all sorts of cash. And the strategies, in the view of some people, are deliberately unsuccessful in order to maintain the ground cover, as it were, to protect these resources. So there's a certain realpolitik that enters in sometimes into the proponents of conflict, isn't there? And people are to some extent asking about the status of the Gazan ceasefire in this sense.
Yes, and there's always, complicated. There are always people who make money out of war, whether it's the arms manufacturers, whether it's those who can get their hands on the riches of countries as they fall. I mean, what I think is very interesting, it's just beginning to happen, that we have the massacre of the and the genocide against the Christians in Nigeria. We have Sudanese, which is Muslim on Muslim genocide going on. These are true genocides. I'm very, very skeptical about the idea that you could describe what's happening in Gaza is a genocide, but these
The
are
only word we
preemptive.
have, perhaps, isn't it? Really, I mean, the shock of the optics. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, anyway, leave that to one side. But what is strikingly obvious is that all the international organizations, the Red Cross, the Amnesty International, and of course the whole of the left, this new Corbynite party, and the journalists who shout out the most about Gaza, have just been studiedly silent on the images coming out of Sudan, which are of one of the terrorists in Sudan who has just posted a big smile of him killing 50 people. And the it's a disgrace really that we're not seeing anything like these marches that we get about the situation in Gaza, dreadful as the Gaza situation is. But there just doesn't seem to be any interest if it's Christians being killed by Muslims or Muslims being killed by Muslims. And these atrocities they're on the they seem to be of the order of what happened on October the 7th when the Gazans first attacked Israel and started the war in the most dreadful way imaginable. And yet there doesn't seem to be any interest, and certainly nothing like it the level. Now it's beginning to make a presence on X, on Twitter, and more people I think are beginning to say, why is the left just not interested in these dreadful events in these countries here? The only obvious conclusion that I can see is that when it's Israel doing it, when it's Jews doing it, it gets attention. If it's anybody else doing it, then it's of no interest, which is right at the heart of definitions of anti-Semitism. I'd be very, very happy to revise my view on that if someone could explain to me why the Muslims being murdered in Sudan or the Christians being murdered in Nigeria are less important than the Gazans, and the people dying in the in Gaza. I'd love to know why that's the case, but while it's not, then I think people are bound to come up with the only thing that makes any sense of both the kind of no Jews, no you, no news angle.
Yeah, in the context of well, economic constraints on government and limited options, as you said earlier on, at pivotal times, or the limiting thereof, and Trump's cancellation, more or less, of U.S. aid, when something does kick off, which it inevitably does, getting boots on the ground, so to speak, humanitarian boots on the ground, is a bit of an ask. It's an ask of the public purse, of variations on crowdfunding, the big aid organizations, and then political embargoes on them actually going in and doing their thing. I mean, has the tide turned against humanitarian aid, and are there hidden consequences, if that's the case, in terms of how these devastating countries recover and become economically viable?
I think there's two strands to this. I think when it comes to emergency aid, like the tragedy that we're seeing in Jamaica
Yeah,
this
indeed,
week,
yeah.
then I think the public chips in very, very quickly and very generously. Partly because there's a th you can be reasonably sure that aid is actually going to go to alleviate suffering. I think the increasing problem with and Gaza is an example of this, that money has been poured into Gaza over the last 20 years. Plenty of money there that it could be pretty much another Saudi. But the money which we have paid for as British taxpayers in aid to that region has gone towards building up a terrorist machine of developing underground terrorist tunnels longer in length than the entire London Underground for a relatively small country. And you have the billionaire leaders of Hamas living in 7-star hotels in Qatar, facing none of the hardships that they've imposed on their own people. And the idea that I think I know whether it's true or not, I think there's been a growing perception that quite a lot of this aid money is going to either things that don't really make sense in terms of are these really priorities. India has a space program now. Quite why does it make sense that we continue to provide aid to a country which has an active space program? Well,
I
why
suppose
can't
it's
India?
regional, isn't it? But being such a
Okay,
vast
but
country, but
yeah, but India is still a federal country with national elections, the biggest democracy in the world. And it's a fair question, I think, to say why aren't the Indians spending their space program money on poverty at home? Why should we be paying for that while they make these great investments
Well,
in
technology, yeah.
price their nature? And the so I think that there is that angle now, I think, to the aid debate, which was much more suppressed, I think, you go back a little while, as to the whole concept of whether it is. And I think that has meant the countries which or parties within countries that are not particularly well disposed towards aid in the first place have a ready-made excuse to cut aid. But even those who are genuinely see the case for aid and for helping to alleviate poverty and how that can lead ultimately to a more peaceful world. Many of those are beginning to question whether at least some of the money which has been spent on aid has been well directed or not.
One thinks of Gaza as a relatively thriving city before the conflict, whatever the rights and wrongs of how that got started. And there is, as we were saying earlier on, there's money to be made for the likes of Halliburton with its former political connections in the Bush administration, Bush the Younger, to sort of to rebuild, but to rebuild with whatever sense of democracy and public buy-in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what public buying would look like in Gaza because the polls coming out still suggest that Hamas would be elected in any elections that came up. If you did create a Gazan state, you could hardly then say, right, we're going to create a state, but we're going to limit your choices in elections. You can do that. And in Germany and Japan post-war, there were very severe restrictions on what they were allowed to do as sovereign countries. But the problem still comes down that while there is a strong Hamas presence, and Hamas made very clear that its goal in life is to wipe is to wipe Jews off the world map, and Christians indeed, and they they're very happy to sacrifice people. Their hatred of Jews is, their love of death is greater than their love of life, which it's very difficult to see how you can possibly move forward when that's a dominant philosophy. If you see the way that so many children now in that area have been taught to wave weapons and to use weapons, and been told that if you stab Jews, then you'll go to heaven. It's been done before. Germany was denazified. Japan was taken away from being an extraordinarily cruel country in the lead up to the Second World War and during the Second World War, to countries that are, among the most civilized and forward-looking in the world.
Again, one thinks of Germany in the 80s. Certainly, I spent a few years there, and it was, to me, it was the antidote to Thatcher's Britain. I mean, that's the very personal view. It's just it was had much more of a human face.
Yeah, and so you can. And it was, denazification was the word that we used in Germany. It can be done, but it's a long, slow process, and it has to be done with the start has to be of completely eliminating the caste that caused the problem, the Nazis in Germany, and the more extreme military regimes in Japan. Israel lives in perfect peace with Jordan. Indeed, Jordan's been very helpful in terms of helping Israel to withstand the attacks from the Hezbollah coming from the north. It's live Israel and Egypt have sensible relations. Israel and Saudi. Most of the Arab world seems now to have accepted Israel And Israel's got no interest at all in attacking those countries or causing problems for those countries. Just the opposite. It's just the this cluster of thing around the Houthi, around Hezbollah, around Hamas, and one suspects a lot of it being supported from Iran, with Qatar playing a dodgy role in the probably. If that could be overcome, then you could end up with much more sensible relations with the between the Arab and the Israeli worlds. Then that would be a brilliant, brilliant thing for world peace, and it would be a brilliant, brilliant thing for the children living in Gaza and elsewhere, and in southern Lebanon and all these flashpoints. But to get to that point, you would have to find a way of isolating and then eliminating the philosophy that sees war as being a holy thing, and whose whole point of existence in life is to try to murder people who hold a different religious view.
It's
I'm
very
not.
Oceania in 1984 when you think, look at it that way, isn't it? Really,
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I think it's I'm not the Ahmadiyya Muslims who get who yeah, there's been another dreadful attack in Pakistan recently on the Ahmadiyyas.
I still really could, after all these years.
They see their faith as being a strong motivator to be out in community, helping people where they can, interacting with other faiths in a positive way. Of course, remaining true to their own faith, and that's a freedom that people should have.
But offering its fruits to everyone, really.
Yes, indeed, and enriching society, which they do. And so it's not, it's not that Islam itself cannot be interpreted in a modern civilized way. It clearly can.
Or the ancient civilized way.
Yeah, it's just that there is a strand of extreme Islamism, which is, ultimately just entirely negative, it seems to me. I don't see anybody benefit from it apart from the men at the top. We've now got in Afghanistan, it's now been told that women are only allowed to have one eye that they can see through from underneath.
I have a client there at the moment, and I'm really worried that she's not going to be able to make it back.
It's just an appalling perversion of what we can be as human beings. That is at the moment, and there's been a lot of debate about Islamophobia. It's important to separate out the perfectly sensible and logical criticism of these strands of Islam, to keep that apart from saying, oh, the word Islam, therefore bad people, because in my ward and right the way through London, there are not just Ahmadiyyas, but Muslims from all the various strains who are, genuinely great people who who contribute a great deal to our local communities, who are good neighbors. I would say, of all the groups, there's lots of really nice people in West Hill, but if I was really pushed, the group that's most likely to almost strong arm you into coming in for a cup of tea, and then it's not a cup of tea because there's always the sweets come out or they
Oh,
want their
yeah.
own meal. And it's the Islamic community who are enormously full of hospitality and
It's
full of
generosity is an
friendly.
act of faith, really, isn't it?
Indeed, and we must absolutely must hold on to onto that, while at the same time being, I think, absolutely ruthless in preventing the extremist strands of Islam from making a foothold in our society, and I'm afraid they are making that foothold at the moment.
Well, some would say, well, if we can again tilt away slightly, that what's happening to Paddington Bear recently on Spitting Image is the end of civilization as we know it. A sort of brutalization that's, in legal terms, is a step too far for Canal Plus, who produced the Paddington films. The estate of Michael Bond, which does not license the Spitting Image version. There is also, and I'm deeply troubled by this, one of the members of McFly is co-authoring a Paddington musical, which to me is a step too far. I hope that will be swiftly buried, but poor old Paddington is in the wars. What do you think about the iconic stations of national treasures, and are they enhanced by being lampooned or instrumentalized to look at the world as we, ironically, as it were, to look at the world as we now have it?
Yeah, I mean, art ought to be a bit provocative. That's part of its role in society is to make us look at things slightly differently. I must admit the Paddington story has passed me by, but I think there are some groups in society which I should which I think we should be very careful about protecting and making their lives easier. Fictional
Bears,
bears,
particularly bears from Peru.
well, fictional bears from Peru, I'm not sure do fit into that. Category, actually. That being said, there is a dreadful musical around Anne Frank at the moment, which
Is
is
there?
re, yeah, she's
Why are they
reinventing
so
the old
bad
Greek
now?
myth. Because of the because of what they've done to, it's a Anne Frank is very, it's actually remarkably live among the Jewish community as a symbol of what happened to them in the, particularly during the Second World War, but indeed through the anti-Semitism through the ages. And she's been recreated as a gender neutral, almost, it seems to be almost a carbon copy of what killed off Doctor Who.
Not for a bit. He's a Time Lord after all,
Which
and
has caused a lot of offence among, now, it's very important that we hold on clear to the idea that nobody has a right not to be offended. And that, but this seems almost gratuitous. And I think I certainly wouldn't censor it. I certainly wouldn't say it shouldn't be allowed to happen. I'm against that. But I think it was insensitive in the in not recognizing how this was trivializing a something which is still,
That's the
that,
key word here, isn't it? Trivializing,
I mean, I don't think you can really. It should sound harsh, but you can't really trivialize Paddington, because the essence of Paddington, the thing that makes Paddington so wonderful, is that it is trivial, that it doesn't seep itself in politics, and like, Paddington is a very enjoyable character. I think many of us will remember that lovely scene with Her Late Majesty and Paddington, where the Queen takes a marmalade
So
sandwich
she
out of
must.
her handbag. I mean, that was just wonderful. It was very, very funny. I thought the Queen was great in it, and that's, so trivializing is not a word you can really apply to something whose whole point in life is to offer unreflective joy in the way that Paddington's done so effectively.
I suppose one of the arguments might be that people invest, as is often said with celebrity in general, perhaps rather egregiously these days, invest a bit of themselves in this iconic character. And when they think of them, they think of where they were in life at the time, as a small person or a larger person.
Yeah, no doubt that we have, well, we pick up memories almost without noticing them through life, and then those memories can be triggered by all sorts of things. And much loved childhood characters like Paddington are always going to be in that category. And
Good
though,
triggers for once,
yeah, but I don't, because triviality is extremely important, if I can be mildly paradoxical.
It is, you sound like Twain when you say that. Grimson's fourth law.
Well, yeah, Heidegger has a phrase about the saving grace of the trivial, and about how, and David Hume as well, when he goes through, when he's getting very skeptical about the world, and when in, I mean, he's a great writer. I'm very
Sort of
fond of
give me a
Heidegger.
break volume, as it were.
There's one where he says, when he gets all depressed, when he does all this stuff about whether there is any causation and whether we can know anything about the future. And he says, and he gets really caught in this. And then a mate comes around and says, "Do you want a game of backgammon?" And they go off and play backgammon, and very, very quickly he's cheered up again. And I think that is, these, pastimes of that nature, the things that you can get involved in, but you know they're not terribly important at the end of the day, paradoxically are an enormously important part of keeping humans
And children's
sane.
education, is there? Because again, these are the interludes and the instructive interludes, the hinting interludes of what's to come.
So in no way am I degrading Paddington or saying that Paddington is a wonderful thing, because I think he is. And but on the other hand, we've got to allow satire to go wherever satire wishes to go, I guess. And it's fine for us to find some of these things distasteful, as I do with the Anne Frank thing. And it's a very different thing from saying that it shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, so it's sort of it's a transient thing, as it were. It takes its natural selection, I suppose, place in the pantheon of creativity.
Yeah, so some of these things last a long time for being transient. Paddington's been around a long time, as have the nursery rhymes that go back centuries and are still
Still in the
presented
curriculum, I
to our
discovered the other
children.
day. Yes,
Yeah, indeed, and those things that root us in our culture. I think again, as a group of things. Are very important, but their kind of im their importance lies, in a sense, in their triviality.
Well, it's that time of the morning, but I have to go off for the daily rendition of the Wheels on the Bus, heavy metal style. Mal, thank you very much. Have a
Okay.
great weekend.
And you, cheers.
Thanks.